Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, the field is being winnowed. There are now 6-7, if you still count Jim Gilmore, Republicans left in the race for the nomination. Two have left since the results came down in New Hampshire Tuesday night. We talked yesterday about the exit of Chris Christie, and let's just say the tears were not exactly flowing here at the Three Martini Lunch. But the good martini today is not that Carly Fiorina is also out. The good martini is that Carly Fiorina was in this race, not only because she brought some private sector experience to the race, she was an excellent debater, she was a good articulator of conservative principles in many ways, and she is perhaps without peer in being able to zero in and go after Hillary Clinton. In her statement yesterday, the quality of the statement compared to Chris Christie's was just like night and day. I'm not even going to mention Christie's, but just listen to this. "We must fix our festering problems by holding our bloated, inept government bureaucracy accountable. Republicans must stand for conservative principles that lift people up and recognize all Americans have the right to fulfill their God-given potential. To young girls and women across the country, I say, do not let others define you. Do not listen to anyone who says you have to vote a certain way or for a certain candidate because you're a woman. That is not feminism. Feminism does not shut down conversations or threaten women. It's not about ideology. It's not a weapon to wield against your political opponent. A feminist is a woman who lives the life she chooses and uses all of her God-given gifts. And always remember that a leader is not born but made. Choose leadership." So, Jim, ultimately, she was never able to sustain things from debate to debate, and she never put up much of a vote total in Iowa or New Hampshire, so she was right to get out. But the campaign was better for having Carly Fiorina in it.
It was, Greg. And I just make share an observation. I think it was Gabriel Mellor who noted this, that for a lot of candidates, the two best days of their campaign are the day that they announce it and begin and the day they leave. Because the day you begin, well, you know, it's full of hope and optimism. It's like the first day of spring training, first day of training camp. People are like, oh, this could be a strong candidate. There's a lot of rises and stumbles along the way. And then usually on the last day, everyone looks and says, oh, you know what? They didn't win, but they added a lot to the race. They had brought a lot to the table, and we salute them. And that happens for just about every candidate, except Chris Christie. So I had a couple of tweets yesterday. I just think it's worth noting about Carly Fiorina before she departs the stage and goes off to do something else. We've seen a lot of people from the business world jump into the realm of politics. Sometimes they are unsuccessful. You can think of H. Ross Perot. Sometimes they are successful. You know, Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, comes to mind. But a lot of times, and I've covered a lot of races, you get somebody who's been very successful in the business world, and they think, oh, I know how to do this, and they jump in, and they don't know how to do this, that actually the skills of politics and the skills of business, it's like a Venn diagram. They overlap some, but not entirely. And they run into trouble. They have a hard time building coalitions. They can't win people over. In a lot of cases in the realm of business, you know, you don't need to persuade as much because you're in charge, because you're the CEO. You just say, we're going to do X, and X happens, and either it succeeds or it doesn't. Politics is much more about, you know, kind of goading people and persuading people. So one thing that really stood out about Carly Fiorina, every speech you saw, every debate you saw, almost every interview, Carly Fiorina did her homework. We can argue about how well she did in that 2010 Senate race, but she knew that if she was going to run for president, she had to know these issues backwards and forwards. And, you know, people say, oh, she memorized, you know, from her briefing books. No, she knew this stuff. And I think we really underestimate the value of that. And I'm not deliberately trying to draw a contrast with the front runner. But, you know, I think it says something that she took the office of the presidency seriously enough that she wanted to really know what she was talking about, not just wing it based on, you know, whatever's written on the note card. The other thing which I think is worth noting, particularly as we see Republican field get larger year after year, often by a lot of long shots, often by a lot of folks who, you know, really the longest of long shots who don't seem to have any plausible road to the presidency and who seem to be running their campaigns as simply book tours on a larger scale. Look, Carly Fiorina was wealthier than you and I are ever going to be, Greg. Mitt Romney looks at her and says, wow, she's rich, okay? And so Carly Fiorina wasn't running for a Fox News gig or a book deal or speaking fees or anything like that. She already was an accomplished person. She, you know, she was effectively retired. I know she was doing other volunteer work and things like that. But basically, this is a woman who had done what she, you know, she could retire happily for the rest of her life. The only reason she was running is because she actually believed what she said. She actually believed that these were the ideas and policies that were needed to get America back on track. And you can like her, you could not like her. I liked her a lot. I don't know if I would have ended up voting for her if she'd remained all the way to Virginia, but she was a good, you know, she added a lot. She was a breath of fresh air in what has been a pretty dismal campaign season in a lot of ways. So, you know, we will miss her. Early on, it looked like, ah, well, you know, you do well in the debates and that's what launches you to the top tier. And it never really happened for her. The ultimate lesson of that, Greg, is that somebody watching a debate can have three or four favorites. But when the pollster calls, or when they actually go to the primary or caucus booth, they can only support one. And I think Carly Fiorina was the kind of figure who was, for a lot of people, second, third, fourth, maybe even fifth choice. But she was up there, but she wasn't the favorite enough. And in the end, that's what you have to do.
On to the bad martini now, Jim. And we've had plenty of frustrations over the years with the intersection of the media and liberal politicians. We've talked about the fact that the Obama administration has held the press at bay more than any other administration, yet there doesn't seem to be any lack of cheerleading from certain sectors of the media. But when it becomes like this, it becomes very troubling when a free press is critical to a free society. Gawker is reporting, and take that caveat with what it is, but they've got screenshots of this stuff, so it appears to be legit. Gawker has discovered an email exchange that occurred between The Atlantic's Mark Ambinder and Clinton spokesman Philippe Raines over at the State Department. This is back in July of 2009, July 15th to be exact. And Hillary Clinton later that day was going to give a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Ambinder emailed Raines and asked for a copy of the speech ahead of time. And he said he'd do it on two conditions. And here's what the email says. Three, actually. Number one, you in your own voice describe them as muscular. Number two, you note that a look at the CFR seating plan shows that all the envoys from Holbrooke to Mitchell to Ross will be arrayed in front of her, which you, in your own clever way, can say certainly is not a coincidence and is meant to convey something. And number three, don't say you were blackmailed. So here's Ambinder's lead once he gets the script. When you think of President Obama's foreign policy, think of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. That's the message behind a muscular speech that Clinton is set to deliver today to the Council on Foreign Relations. The staging gives a clue to its purpose. Seated in front of Clinton, subordinate to Clinton, in the first row will be three potentially rival power centers, envoys Richard Holbrooke and George Mitchell, and National Security Council Senior Director Dennis Ross. What's more outrageous here, Jim, that Raines and the government would demand that a reporter report something in a specific way, or that the reporter would bow and do exactly what they wanted?
Yeah, it's a really revealing exchange here, Greg. And I'll point out, look, as somebody who's had to work with campaigns and work with government officials and tried to, you know, hey, I want to write about X, you know, what access can you give me? Can you give me a sense of what's going to be in the speech and stuff like that? And then the negotiations begin. And so, you know, there've been a lot of times of, we'll give you an advance copy, but you got to honor the embargo. You cannot do it. Or you can write excerpts, but you can't. Or a lot of times the discussions that are on background. I didn't tell you this, but you can say blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, you can write this in your own voice, but you can't say this is coming from us. What we're seeing here with Ambinder and Hillary's flack is a very different category of, we're going to tell you what to write. And I think once you do that, once you kind of basically turn into the puppet of the government official, once you let them decide what you're going to write, something is kind of fundamentally broken there. And that's something that I've never given up. I don't think any reporter I've ever known has ever given up a sense of, you know, you tell me what to write and I'll write it. Now, you can give me a quote. I may, you know, I'll quote it. We can argue. You can tell me something and it'll be off the record. It's different. But this whole thing of, you use the word muscular in your own voice. No, you don't get to pick your own adjectives. Greg, it's like being able to pick your own nickname.
Right.
You know, Garrity, who is often referred to as Stud Muffin, you know, you don't get to do that. And, you know, the point about who's in the one, I think it's very revealing that it was a huge deal about who was sitting in the audience and where they were sitting and all that kind of stuff. But I think Mark Ambinder's got a good reason to feel a little embarrassed by this. My suspicion is this is not as uncommon as we would like it to be. There are times I have read things that it has felt a little too much like what somebody in the White House would want them to write. There's another Washington journalist who often uses the term mind meld, as in, here's what the White House is thinking. Now, when somebody says, here's what the White House is thinking, you should interpret that as, here's what somebody at the White House told me they're thinking, but they don't want to say, somebody from the White House told me they're thinking this. So, you know, I'm going to pretend I have clairvoyance. I'm going to pretend that I have telepathy and this is what they're thinking, which is fine. But you kind of know at that point, I'm writing this because, you know, Rahm Emanuel called me up and yelled at me and told me that this is what they're thinking.
Ari Fleischer, I believe, tweeted out yesterday something to the effect of, if this had happened or if I had tried this at the White House, there would have basically been a press riot in reaction to it once it came.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is ultimately they're happy to get the scoop. Here's the thing. You're never in danger of being spun by the politicians you hate. It's the politicians you like where it gets clubby, where it gets too easygoing, where you kind of feel like you're on their team and you're supposed to help them out. And I think that Ambinder, I don't think Ambinder, it's very hard to see Mark Ambinder doing the same thing for a Republican White House or a Republican lawmaker, saying you're going to describe our speech as muscular in your own voice.
Yeah, nor should he. You shouldn't do that for either side. All right, on to the crazy martini now. And we addressed this just kind of in passing yesterday in reaction to the dominant win by Bernie Sanders in the New Hampshire primary. Sanders won 60% to 38. So, of course, Hillary Clinton comes out of New Hampshire with more delegates, 15 to 13. Same thing kind of happened in Iowa, where it was a dead heat. And thanks to the superdelegates, these are elected officials, state party officials, Democratic National Committee members from that state, who get to vote for whoever they want, regardless of the outcome of the caucus or primary. We saw this a lot in 2008 because a ton were initially committed to Hillary. And then when they saw the Obama groundswell, they switched to Obama, much to the consternation of the Hillary team. And ultimately that got him the nomination. And so, Jim, since delegates that are awarded based on the actual vote are done proportionally in the Democratic Party, it's easy to see someone who wins a vast majority of states, but by a fairly competitive margin, just to get trumped at the convention because of all these superdelegates in the tank for a candidate, and none of it's decided by the actual people.
Yeah. Now, people, you know, why do the Democrats have superdelegates and Republicans don't? A lot of this came out of George McGovern, that they realized that, oh my goodness, we'd lost control of the nominating process and our grassroots are a bunch of maniacs. We need some way to stop this. But what we'll do is, we'll say that a certain amount of superdelegates have to be women, a certain number of superdelegates have to be African-American, and that way we'll be able to say, oh, this is a fairer system, this is a way of making sure everybody's voice is heard and represented, yada, yada, yada. But ultimately, it was about creating a circumstance in which that basically people who are in the party, senators, governors, those elected to statewide office, state party chairs, all that kind of stuff, that all of that basically end up having a lot of say in who the party ends up nominating. And this is the end result, that basically, if you're part of the Democratic elites, part of the Democratic establishment, you probably signed on to Hillary a long time ago because you're awaiting your job in the Hillary Clinton administration, right? This is effectively what you do for a living, and that's the perspective there. Now, because of this, you know, you have the coin flip result in Iowa, which you end up getting more delegates. Now, with this one, she gets utterly shellacked, and because almost all the state's superdelegates are backing Hillary Clinton, she actually is going to come out of this with more delegates, and, you know, even though he won by like 20 points. I wrote about this morning, and a bunch of people are like, well, there are a bunch of Republicans who are like, so what? This is the Democrats. It's their messed up system. Why do we care? And I can see that perspective, but Greg, BS is BS.
Yes.
Like, depending, you know, like I'm willing to stand up for Bernie Sanders and say he's getting a raw deal here, right? It's been this way with the debates. It's been this way with, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the DNC. Somebody said to me, well, with Trump being the front runner, don't you wish you had superdelegates in the Republican Party? And my answer, I don't know about you, Greg, my answer is no. I actually don't think it's good to have that, because at a certain point you'd have this kind of divide, which your superdelegates want one person, the rest of the party, you know, the grassroots of the party wants another. And you end up with this divide, and the superdelegates could have a possibility of winning if it's close, you know, if the elite candidate does well enough. That's pretty much what we're seeing on the Democratic side. You have to let your party be free to make the wrong choice. And Republicans, right now, you're making the wrong choice. We may be on a path to disaster by nominating Trump. But I don't want to like put in some sort of mechanism to overrule that by a small group of people just because I think they're wrong. Because then, Greg, it struck me as like a Clockwork Orange system. You are forced to make the right decision. You are forced to make the decision that somebody else thinks is the correct one. And if it's not freely chosen, is it really the right choice? You have to leave people free to get it wrong. That's kind of what liberty is about. That's kind of what freedom is about. And every effort to stop freedom and liberty always comes from, we're going to save people from making the wrong choice. Now, you might argue in light of that, you know, a fundamentally unfree system for weighting the results of elections, maybe it fits the Democrats.
Can't you just picture Bernie at the next debate saying, not only is Wall Street rigged, this process is rigged.
I'm out of order. You're out of order. This whole court is out of order. it's going to be interesting to see. The guy who's railing on about fairness and the system is rigged might not get the nomination because of unfairness and because the system is rigged.
How ironic.
Feel the burn. There's one other way to interpret this, Greg.
What's that?
That in the name of fairness, some of Bernie's delegates were reallocated to somebody they felt was less fortunate.
Yeah, they don't belong to him. They belong to the whole party, right?
There you go. Choke on that irony.
Be careful what you wish for, Bernie. All right. On that note, Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.